morning. Welcome to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair and Greg Bach coming to you live from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can always join the show. Call or text at 855-75-CIVIC or leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and the platform that Elon has ruined. Very excited to have our next guest with us. We like to do this, once a month or so.
Absolutely.
Where we expand beyond just the dairy industry in Wisconsin and highlight one of the many, many things that we grow in Wisconsin and manufacture in Wisconsin. So our guest is the sole employee of Micro Myco Growers. Andrew Griffin is here, and he grows mushrooms. Good morning, Andrew. There you go. So glad to have you here. We've been waiting to get you on for a couple of weeks, and we finally had the opportunity. And I saw this article in the Wisconsin State Journal that had talked about you have no horticulture background. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I actually I don't really have much of a scientific background either. mushroom growing is kind of a burgeoning industry. So, you know, we take all kinds. There's not, even here at UW, a school that's really known for their agronomic research and that sort of thing. Mycology, the study of mushrooms, still falls under the scope of botany, despite them being totally separate animal, or not even animal kingdoms, but just kingdoms of life in general. So there's still a lot of work to be done in the field, and a lot of it comes on the shoulders of amateurs like me.
So how on earth did you even get into this if that's not something that's in your background?
So I've worked with food for a long time. I've worked in kitchens, I've worked on farms, you know, mostly on the supply side of thing, although I do like to eat myself, you know, a little bit of a gourmet. But mushrooms offer a really nice way to grow food in an urban environment using other agricultural byproducts very sustainably. So all those things together kind of make it a very attractive industry as we're looking for new ways to change up our protein production and consumption, but also start growing new products that people might be interested in.
Andrew, what are the good things about mushrooms? Because I had a friend many years
ago.
That's
a long list. Yeah.
It kind of
depends on which way you want to slice it. So, I mean, I'm really interested in food production.
Yeah. Little growing joke there.
Yeah.
No, but this guy maintained that mushrooms had no nutritional value and therefore he would not eat them because they're fungus.
Okay. Well, the primary macronutrient in mushrooms is protein. So if you're eating a mushroom, most of the nutritional content is going to be protein. It's not as dense as, you know, meat or eggs, but it's more dense than a lot of other what are considered plant proteins. So if you're looking for ways to switch up your protein consumption from animal products, mushrooms offer a great variety. In addition, the health benefits beyond nutritionally are really understudied, but becoming more and more popular. You may know people who are taking mushroom supplements or people who are trying to introduce mushrooms to their diets for, you know, kind of therapeutic effects. And so those two things together make mushrooms a really, really great part of a well-balanced diet for sure.
Is there one mushroom that is superior over another mushroom? I mean,
starting wars.
Well, the little white mushrooms that you find in the store that are pretty common.
That is a great question.
That seems to me like that would be the lesser of the shrooms.
Yeah, no, and you're totally right. That's kind of the ubiquitous American mushroom as well. So, you know, what we know is the white button mushroom. The species name, the Latin binomial for that is Agaricus bisporus. That is kind of the American mushroom. Little known fact, portobellas are that same species of mushroom, just at a different stage of growth and maybe slightly different genetics. So you go to the grocery store, you see the mushroom section, you know, you got white button mushrooms, portobello mushrooms, and maybe cremini mushrooms. Those are all the same type of mushroom, just marketed differently. So a lot of people think they might have tried different mushrooms. You know, they might say my favorite mushrooms are portobello rather than the white button mushrooms, but they're actually talking about the same thing. There's just not a whole lot of consumer variety when you're talking about mushroom production. So that's where I kind of specialize. I'm growing everything except for those Agaricus bisporus mushrooms. So in my opinion, there's a lot of variety that's out there in terms of mushrooms, variety and flavors and textures that most people would never come across because they didn't even realize they had the choice. So there might not be a better mushroom per se, but there's a lot of variety out there that most people are unfamiliar with. So, you know, if there is a better mushroom, most people probably haven't tried it yet.
Just make sure when you tell them that Portobello and Whitecap are the same, you push your glasses up while saying, well, actually, yeah, they are the same mushroom, sir. I don't know if you know that.
It is really hard not to be extremely pedantic in a field so rife with folklore and knowledge and, you know, that sort of thing. But I do indulge a little bit. It's kind of fun to be, you know, the unknown expert for sure.
Oh, that's hilarious. If you're just joining us, Andrew Griffin is our guest. He formed Micro Growers, again, according to this article, out of boredom in November of 2020, Andrew. So,
well, you know, November 2020, there's a lot of boredom there, but it was kind of induced boredom. You know, everyone's locked up at home, not going anywhere. I just moved back to Madison a few months prior, and I'd worked on farms during the summer, you know, while you can be outside, that sort of thing. But not a whole lot of places were hiring, you know, at the height of kind of COVID craziness.
Right.
So it seemed like a good time to kind of just jump off and do my own thing, something that I definitely believed in.
If you have a question for Andrew, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Andrew, how many mushrooms are you producing on a weekly basis from your little place in Madison?
So in terms of variety, I call five species bulk crops. So that's what I'm growing as my, you know, my primary production. Those are going out to restaurants. And then I do maybe like three or four rotating specialty varieties as well. Stuff that doesn't produce as in good of quantity and is a little bit, you know, a little bit further out there, a little bit less familiar to most people. So they don't sell as well, but the novelty goes a long way. So I typically grow about eight different kinds a month, but in varying quantities for sure. My bulk products are going to be like oyster mushrooms and lion's mane, which there's a lot of people familiar with, and then other specialty stuff like trumpets or chestnut mushrooms, you know, that sort of thing.
Do they vary wildly in flavor, or do all mushrooms essentially taste pretty much the same?
Well, you know, the salesman in me wants to say that there's this great big spectrum, but most mushrooms do taste like mushrooms first, and then like you're describing secondary flavor characteristics. You know, that's when you can really start to use a lot of the adjectives. But I'd say most mushrooms taste like mushrooms first. The bigger difference is definitely going to be what you're getting in texture. So texture is a huge component of, you know, the way that something tastes or the way that you feel when you eat it.
Right.
And the kind of mushroom texture that people are familiar with, and those white bud mushrooms or those portobello mushrooms, there's a huge, huge variety in terms of what you can get from mushroom texture. And I think that's really the bigger selling point to me, is probably more the texture than flavor, especially when you're talking about mushrooms as a protein supplement. You know, they really do get pretty close to that meat texture-ness, especially in terms of like satisfaction. You know, when you bite down on something and you chew it, you kind of get that kind of like carnivore primal feeling of like gnawing on a little bit. I think mushrooms give that pretty well too.
And certainly from you get that from the portobellos, right? That's a
yeah, exactly. That's a meatier, right. That's a great example. Yep, yeah, for sure.
That's a meatier kind of mushroom.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of mushrooms be used as like replacements for meat and like vegan. I can't remember. Like a lot of times like a vegan beef almost, and you like bulk it up and it's just, I've had it and it's delicious. And I don't dare people, but I challenge you to try them, because a lot of people will say, well, it's not the same. It's not the same. It's not the same thing at all, but it's still very delicious.
Well, and as we learn now, mushrooms have protein.
Yes, they do.
Yes. Yep. Yes, they do. Yeah. So they kind of grow with a grain to them, almost like meat. You know, you kind of got that stringiness and like a steak or a piece of chicken or something like that. Mushrooms do a really good job emulating that. One of my favorite mushroom dishes of all time is a lion's mane crab cake. So, you know, you can use that kind of stringiness and pull them apart and form them into a good crab cake. And it tastes, it's got a little bit of like kind of seafood flavor, a little bit of sweet, a little bit fragrant. If you didn't tell anybody, they might not even know the difference. That's like, you know, I got to bring mushrooms every dinner party I go to, every time we're getting together with friends.
Sure.
It's gotta be mushrooms. And that's kind of my go-to, just because it blows people's minds, you know. It's totally outside what they'd expect is possible from mushrooms.
Jane, next time Andrew's coming in studio for an interview, this is all there is to it.
You're going to have to bring us food, Andrew, unfortunately.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. That's my favorite thing in the world. That's the best part about growing food, is sharing it, especially when it's like something so far out there, you know?
Yeah.
It's really fun to watch people's faces light up and see that there's something. You don't often come across something completely new that you've never experienced before. And I think that happens kind of a lot with mushrooms, just because there's really not a lot of availability out there.
Andrew Griffin is our guest. We are going beyond the cheese as we talk about mushrooms and his mushroom growing operation in Madison. Tom from LA has a comment about mushrooms, Tom.
Yeah, no questions actually and comments. Andrew, first off, I haven't eaten animals in 10 years, and when I grew up in Wisconsin, that's all I did was eat, you know, meat, potatoes, I mean everything that we ate in Wisconsin. And dairy and everything. And like I said, I have been not eating animals for 10 years, and it's so interesting because I ran into the king oyster mushroom. And one thing I used to love when I ate chicken was the I know this sounds gross, but I love the cartilage off the chicken. And I missed that part for some reason. And the thing is, the mushroom, the king oyster mushroom, has that same texture as that. So it's like I feel like I won the lottery when I got to taste the mushroom that has that same texture, and it does have a meat texture to it. You know, it's not like people that say, oh, have this squirrel, it tastes just like meat. No, this is so different because it's the texture. It there's something just so great about mushrooms. And the question I have real quick is, when you get a bunch of mushrooms and you freeze them, how do you thaw them back out so therefore they still remain the way that they were, or do you just buy them fresh and don't do the freezing part or anything like that?
That's a good question. Sure. Yeah. Good question, Tom.
Yeah, in my opinion, the best way to save mushrooms is to dry them out and then rehydrate them if you can, and that's going to give you the best texture on the other end. But if you are going to freeze them, definitely par cook them first in a little bit of oil. And that'll maintain more of that meaty texture as you thaw them, so they're not just going to be in water. You know, getting a little fat in there goes a long way in maintaining that texture.
Otherwise, they're just going to be all squishy, I suppose.
All the water's going to come right out. Yep, exactly.
Andrew, do you have time to stay for another segment?
Yeah, of course. Yep.
If you have a question about mushrooms, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream and stay close. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You don't mean no harm, you just don't know what else to do about it.
Beyond the Chief. Welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair and Greg Bach coming to you live from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can always join us, call or text 855-75-CIVIC. Leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and or Twitter. Our guest is Andrew Griffin, who started Micro Growers in 2020. And he grows mushrooms. And so we're talking about mushrooms and taking your calls and your texts. Mark from Prairie du Sac has been on the line. Good morning, Mark. Did you have a question?
Morning. Yeah. When I go pheasant hunting in the fall, there's frequently a lot of people out there plucking mushrooms. But I've noticed in some of the spots there's the giant puffballs, which are really impressive in size. They're bigger than a softball, a couple of softballs sometimes.
Wow.
And how would you actually prepare those?
Puffballs are kind of an interesting one. They're, you know, when it comes to mushroom foraging, a big thing that people are concerned about is making sure they're not going to poison themselves. And when you come across a giant puffball, you know, there's nothing else that's grown in the woods that's pure white and looks like the size of a volleyball. So it's pretty obvious of what it is. So that naturally attracts a lot of people to giant puffballs. I forage a lot of different kinds of mushrooms, and I've eaten giant puffballs. I'm going to be honest, they're not my most favorite. You know, I have the luxury of being a little bit of a mushroom snob since it is my job and since I got a little bit more knowledge than most people. But the best way I've ever had them is just kind of fry it up like tofu, you know, get a little browning on them and season how you like. But it's as far as mushroom textures go, you know, in that wide variety of what's out there, they're a little bit closer to the undesirable side, in my opinion. So I usually leave them be. I have really haven't found a good way to make them taste very good. So I'm afraid I don't have a great answer for you there.
That's really interesting. Is what is the texture like of those puffballs, Andrew?
It's like kind of halfway between styrofoam and tofu, in my opinion. Really kind of like crumbly dry. I know it's really selling them here. the most fun thing you can do with them, in my opinion, is, get a running start and wind up with a really big kick, and kind of just disperse the spores all over. They kind of explode on contact, which is always a treat. But just looking at them, there's, like I said, there's nothing else out there. They're really, really pretty cool to see.
Thank you so much, Mark. Really appreciate the call. And as you mentioned too, Andrew, you do have to be careful if you're going to forage on your own, because there are mushrooms that can kill you.
Yeah, for sure. I think mushrooms get a bad rap. There's a lot of plants out there that can kill you. They just don't maybe look so as menacing as mushrooms do. We've got this kind of cultural knowledge of mushrooms being poisonous or, a drug or some sort of thing that people are using in witchcraft. But there's only maybe a few actually deadly species in Wisconsin. And just if you're an amateur forager, those are kind of the first ones that you learn. So you really learn what to stick away from before you can learn what you're looking to eat.
Texter Anna, listening here in WAUK, I've heard that mushroom coffee is very popular now.
Yes. So, that kind of goes back on the medicinal side of mushrooms. They don't have caffeine, so it's not going to be coffee, kind of a stimulant boost, but they offer a lot of other nutrition that people find, stimulating. So really high in vitamin or mineral content. People substitute coffee. I think it kind of goes back to just, it's nice to have a hot cup of something to drink in the morning.
Sure.
But mushroom coffees are becoming a really popular way to supplement your diet with some of the more medicinal varieties instead of having to seek them out and take pills or something like that. It's a nice, convenient way to have maybe a dozen different kinds of medicinal mushrooms all at once.
Catherine from Madison, listening on WMDX. Jane, can you ask Andrew the best way to dry mushrooms at home? I've heard they make excellent broth.
They do, yeah. So a lot of the extra stock that I have at the farm, I dry out and use specifically for mushroom broth. They kind of tend to intensify flavor a little bit. So what I use is just typically a dehydrator, just whatever your dehydration setting, about 125 degrees for maybe 12 to 16 hours, and they'll dry out just fine. You slice them a little bit. And that's a good way to preserve a lot of forage mushrooms as well. And then just rehydrating them simply in water, you kind of get that mushroom broth along with it, and then the rehydrated mushrooms that you can use in cooking just as you would fresh mushrooms. So it's a really great way to store them. An interesting thing, if you're interested in vitamin D supplementation at all, mushrooms actually produce nutritionally soluble vitamin D. They're one of the few produce sources that do that. So they're melanated as well. So, the same thing in our skin that produces vitamin D when exposed to sunlight. If you dry your mushrooms in the sunlight, they'll actually increase concentration of vitamin D. So if you're interested in taking a little bit more time like that, you can just put them in the sun.
I'm learning so much.
I know. It's a little bit of information overload for sure.
No, this is great. This is great.
Mary from Wauwatosa is on the line. Good morning, Mary. Thank you so much for joining us. Do you have a question for Andrew?
Good morning, and thanks so much for addressing this. I'm totally on board with mushrooms. I consume them in various forms every day for my health. On another subject, I've read in Ocean Blue Project, which is trying to get the plastics out of our waterways, that mushrooms are being studied in the research centers for their ability to consume microplastics. And I'm wondering if Andrew has heard anything about that. Sounds like a good thing to me.
That's
off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. That's a fascinating question.
Yes, I actually do know a little bit about this. So this is kind of a pet interest of mine. I do what I do in the interest of sustainability and, using mushrooms in all angles of that. Plastics are just a different organization of carbon molecules. All living things are made out of kind of the same basic elements. And they're just in an unnatural formation that living things don't really know how to decompose. Mushrooms are really interesting because they're kind of these broad decomposers. They can break down plastic, or not plastic, I'm sorry, they can break down woods, they can break down grasses, they can break down, coffee grounds, they can break down all sorts of organic material. Plastics are just like kind of one step removed from that organic material, and they're starting to, go through genetic selection processes of mushrooms that can start to break down these pretty simple plastics. It's a pretty readily available food source. There's microplastics all over the place.
Oh, we just lost you a little bit there.
Oh,
Andrew.
No.
Accelerating the progress.
You dropped out of there for a little bit, Andrew. We missed that last part.
Okay. 1 second. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Sorry about that.
Yep.
Okay.
You're good.
I'm not sure where you lost me, but I was saying, yeah, mushrooms, they're going through genetic selection processes to isolate, you know, these specific species that can start to break down simple plastics. And as that becomes more and more viable, I think we'll start to see myco remediation, meaning mushroom remediation, in popular use probably in the next 10 years or so.
Boy,
it's
that
progressing
would,
pretty quickly.
That would be great because yeah. these
that would be great.
The microplastics is a whole nightmare of its own. It really is.
Yep. Yep.
We had two really quick before we have to get going. We had two questions about you specifically. Is there a place where they can find your mushrooms specifically in Madison grocery stores?
Yes. So I don't do a whole lot of retail. I'm mostly at farmers markets. I'm set up just as a farm, so I'm not doing any packaging or value added or anything like that. So during the season, you can find me at the East Side Farmers Market, the Monroe Street Farmers Market. And then there's a little producer's grocery store on Williamson Street called Grab and Grocery, and they stock some of my mushrooms as well.
Right.
But that's, aside from restaurants, that'd be the only place you can find me.
Well, this has been so interesting, Andrew. We really, really appreciate you joining us. Andrew Griffin started Myco Growers in 2020 and now supplies restaurants. We will get that contact information up in our show notes as far as where people can find your mushrooms at various farmers markets. Thank you so much for joining us, Andrew. I don't know.
Thanks, guys. Yep, that's a blast. I love it.
Get out of the dark, I guess. That's where mushrooms are.
Oh,
all right.
Nice.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Yep.
Stay close. News is next when we return. Maggie Dawn is here. Don't go away. You're listening to Matt and Air on Air on the Civic Media Radio Network. Greg Bach coming to you from our studio in downtown Waukesha. Join the show, call or text 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, or the platform that Elon has ruined. Very excited to have our next guest with us, our friend and colleague, host of the Maggie Dawn Show across the network from 2 to 4 p.m. Maggie Dawn is here. How are you, my friend?
Hey, Jane. Hey, Greg. I love that my lead-in song is Chris Stapleton singing about his dog named Maggie, which is how I tell everybody to remember my name. Like,
seriously?
If you have a dog that's very loyal and female, imagine that, and then the name Maggie will pop in your
head. I knew all of that. I took it in. I just made it work. And Chris and I got together and we wrote this song for
just for you.
It's a damn good song.
Yes, it is. He's a fine, fine human.
I heard you on your show a couple of weeks ago talking about this mandate for America.
Yeah.
And much like Project 2025 that we were talking about in the first hour with Joseph Hecky, this is something I think a vast majority of people are unaware of. And it's critically important that we familiarize ourselves with this, because this is a blueprint for what another Trump administration would be. Right, Maggie?
Yeah, it's so Project 2025 as concept includes basically a few of these different plans. This is the particular one from the Heritage Foundation entitled, quote, Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise. It's 887 pages.
Wow.
And it is deep wonk.
So it is
deep wonk.
It's tough to read.
Yeah. So I educated myself basically by reading a New York Times deep dive article written by Carlos Lozada, published on February 29th. And then I went to the document itself and like verified a few things that he was saying.
Sure.
And read some of the context around some of the quotes that he pulled out. But in large form, it is a blueprint for how to effectively expand executive branch authority beyond anything that we've heard of before, and basically subject everything within our regulatory structure, our rulemaking structure, our law enforcement apparatus to political litmus testing. That is what they're talking about. It's the effective elimination of federal civil service, which for those of you who aren't sort of wonking about these things,
right.
Most people who work in government aren't political appointees. They are technical experts or skills folks who many of whom spend the large majority of their career, and they're protected in effect by civil service rules, which basically means you cannot be fired simply because you do not politically align with whomever's in control. So it requires basically for cause firing. You have to be incompetent, not show up, not work your full load, whatever it is.
That seems reasonable.
Yes. And it exists in government, basically at all levels, local, state, and federal, in a response to basically like Tammany Hall and the great, incredible corruption scandals that we Teapot Dome, et cetera, where cronies and the political elites and favorites were put into places of power to effectively simply help execute whatever the donor class, the rich, think Rockefellers and Vanderbilts, and the politicians that they had handpicked.
Yep.
If you weren't willing to do their bidding, which would increase their power and wealth, you were removed from your job. And that's not good governance. And what this lays out, and it's ironic to me that it's coming from the Heritage Foundation, because, you know, traditional conservatism is, yes, less government. It's not corrupt government that just serves the whims of the individual who happens to be the chief executive and those that donated to his legal fund to, right. to defend him and the many criminal counts against him, or to simply donate to his campaign and have direct access. That's not representative democracy any longer.
Well, and you talked about, again, when we talk about people who are in civil service, a lot of these people have years and years of institutional knowledge.
Correct.
Of how things work, of what is legal, what is not legal, yep. what is the correct, you know, what are the correct channels to go through for this particular position. Just imagine.
It's basically, they basically say if people are not willing to put those objective, evidence-based, experience-based ideas through the political lens to serve the elected president, they should be removed from their positions.
So they want a loyalty pledge.
They do. This is 887 pages of we believe we should be able to politically litmus test everyone that works in federal government. They don't say it that way because that would sound really scary.
Sure.
Right. But like when you decode all of the mumbo jumbo and the techno speak in here, that's basically what it is. They talk about the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and they talk about other science-based arms of the government. And they basically say that the research should fit the political position.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, conclusion first, then back into the research.
Okay, so climate change is a hoax. That's what I want you to prove. Now go backwards.
Correct. So the EPA, for example, for those that perform the agency's research, which is massive, that's a huge part of what the EPA does.
Well, sure.
This document from the Heritage Foundation says that the qualifications, so what we should hire for, is not personal scientific output. In other words, not someone's robust peer-reviewed prior research credentials, but rather, quote, managerial skills. And the research agenda has to be paired and needs to show explicit findings that yield whether, you know, basically these predetermined
outcomes,
political agenda items, not help inform policy with objective research-based data.
It's well, you're cooking the research.
Correct.
You're going to cook the research in order to get the result that you want. This should scare people.
Yeah, here's a quote. Any research conducted with taxpayer dollars serves the national interest in a concrete way in line with conservative principles.
So you have, you can only use conservative science?
As if there was such a thing.
I know, what does that even mean?
I don't know, Jane. I just, everything that I read in this article, I kept like turning the page and getting more and more afraid. Because again, it has this patina of reasonableness. As if there is something called conservative science. There's not, right? They attack longtime career civil servants. They call holdovers with suspect loyalties lacking moral legitimacy. That's a quote.
What is moral legitimacy?
That you
they
agree.
They can define that.
Right? That's exactly right, Greg. They define who is morally legitimate.
And that is directly tied to your loyalty to the commander-in-chief.
Yep.
Just
one other bit. Sorry, Greg.
The book
calls for the reinstatement of Schedule F, a Trump-era executive order that would allow the president and political appointees to convert many career civil service positions into appointed roles, thus making those people easier to dismiss and replace with loyalists. In a memorable euphemism, the book refers to this effort as, quote, identifying programmatic political workforce needs. That's what I'm talking about, like mumbo jumbo. Programmatic political workforce needs? No, you're litmus testing people in what should be objective areas of the executive branch of government.
Just say we want to hire a bunch of lackeys.
Yeah.
Who are going to do everything we want and give us the results that we want. And if
the science that we want
and the science that we want. And it, and unfortunately, if you think that this is only going to be limited to climate science, you're crazy.
Think
about what this would mean about for public health. If there's another pandemic, if there's another virus, something else breaks out that we're not expecting. And they are given the mandate to determine it's not a big threat.
If you think women, just like men, should have access to healthcare and determine what healthcare is most appropriate for them, that would not exist. Because the government should, quote, maintain a biblically based, social science reinforced definition of marriage and family. Strong political leadership is needed to increase efficiency and align the Census Bureau's mission with conservative principles. I'm sorry, the Census Bureau is supposed to count people in the country. That needs to be subjective to political ideology.
Essentially, it's we want you to lie. We want you to make up the numbers that we want, so we can allocate more federal dollars to these areas that we want, essentially.
Yeah, the Department of Health and Human Service Division should now become known as the Department of Life. To enact the most, and quote, to enact the most robust protections for the unborn that Congress will support.
So, really quick, I just want to say something to, we've been getting some text messages that have been denying what we're talking about here. Maggie is currently reading verbatim from the text. This is not misinformation. This is not us making anything up. This is word for word coming from the document that the former president and his army of sycophants have put out.
This is the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah, the Koch brothers.
Right. And just on this Department of Life point, their concern about life is, of course, selective, because later in the document, they call for, quote, finality in dealing with those people that are on death row. So the government can kill those on death row, but the Department of Health and Human Services should be the Department of Life. And, you know, government should, quote, maintain a biblically based social science reinforced definition of marriage and family. Note the use of the term, not just biblically based, as if government should be oriented,
yeah,
but social science, not science, social science.
Maggie Dawn is our guest. She will be here when we return. Stay close. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is
We got time.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you gave me a 30 seconds.
Already. I gave you three.
Oh, that would be three minutes.
We got minutes.
We got three. Well, now I got two and a half.
Jay, so. You just made me feel so much better because I sometimes misread Anya's hand signals, not because she's not giving them to me correctly, but because I'm doing five things at once, like in my head, formulating question and commentating. Right. So someone of your august...
August
experience and credentials makes me feel so much better when I sometimes read the hands wrong.
That's so much better than saying because you're so old and you've been doing this so long.
No. Hardly.
I'll take August.
Jane, August of knowledge. Yes. And
but here's, you know, Trump's talking point when it comes to his criminal charges is that this is weaponized Department of Justice. Well, guess what? The Heritage Foundation says, no, we should just do that. It should be for our side, though.
Yeah, just
if
our
it's
side.
Us.
Yeah, it's fine.
Fine. The Justice Department and the White House counsel should act as a team, end quote.
Wait a minute.
Now, just in case you've never gone into the weeds on this stuff, there has always been a bright line between White House counsel, who is advising the executive office of the president and the individual that holds the presidency in basically a personal capacity as president.
Right.
It has political overtones as well. There is a bright line, a huge wall between White House counsel and the Department of Justice because the political branch of government should not be telling law enforcement who to investigate and who to prosecute.
Yep.
The Heritage Foundation writing it down in Mandate for Leadership, the conservative promise, writing it down that the White House counsel and the DOJ should, quote, act as a team.
That's terrifying. All right, Maggie Dawn, we'll still be here when we return. This is Matt Nair on air on the Civic Media Radio Network.
I can tell you right now that a dog has a soul. And I thought to myself, as we buried her wrong.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to Matt Nair on Air. Jane, Matt Nair, Greg Bach, and Maggie Dawn in studio with us. Catch Maggie's show coming up right after Todd Alba from noon to 2, and then Maggie from 2 to 4 p.m. across the Civic Media Radio Network. We have been talking about this plan from the Heritage Foundation, the mandate for responsible conservative leadership or something.
Whatever.
It's a really long title.
And this is Mandate for Leadership, the conservative promise. It's creepy.
It is creepy.
It's the words mandate and promise together. Scare me.
It sounds like a threat.
It does. It's not a threat, Jane. It's a promise.
That too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Essentially, this will undo our democracy. That's what it is. Right? And pretty much give all of the power to the executive branch, which is fine, I guess, as long as it's Donald Trump.
Well, this is, one of the first things that President Biden said in his State of the Union address. And if you're a conservative, forget that it was Joe Biden that said it. Put these words in Ronald Reagan's mouth. You can't love this country only when you win. Right? And this, my question to the myriad authors and think tank people that help contribute to 887 pages of authoritarianism is, so this is good for Joe Biden too? In other words, you'd be fine with a Democrat doing all of these? That's what's sort of gobsmacking about the whole thing, is that this is a document that they only want to apply if Donald Trump wins. If anybody else wins, then no. Forget all that stuff
bad idea,
we said.
Bad idea.
Right. Yeah. Like, we were talking about how they want the DOJ and White House counsel to act as a team. I was explaining that is not the standard. It has never been the norm. Basically, the only people that ever talked to the Office of White House Counsel are the Attorney General or the Deputy AG. And it's sort of FYI. It's not coordination.
Right.
It's not White House counsel saying, well, here's our list of political enemies. Go start investigating
them. Go after
them. It's not Hoover's FBI, right? Like, that's not government working well. It, again, these are quotes. Vast expansion, quote unquote, of political appointees across the Department of Justice is required beyond those that have traditionally been appointees. And this separation between White House counsel and the Department of Justice mandate for leadership encourages a new administration to, quote, re-examine this policy and determine whether it might be more efficient or more appropriate for communication to occur through additional channels, end quote. Which basically is White House counsel telling the DOJ, here are the political enemy. Here's my political enemies list. This is Nixonian. This is Hoover-esque.
And it shouldn't be a surprise because he has said this is all about retribution and revenge. Donald Trump has.
Yeah.
This is about retribution. This is about revenge.
Should I read more from the mandate?
Really quick, I just want to say this. Earlier in the show, we had Joseph Pecky on, and we were also talking about Project 2025.
Yep.
It was more of like, you know, we're looking at it. He called it weird, and there were some laughs in there. But you are breaking it down in such a way that actually agrees, makes me agree with a text we got from Carmela from Milwaukee. It says, OMG, I am afraid. I keep asking, how can we stop this? I hear Maggie loud and clear, and her answer is to vote. We the people cannot allow Trump and the Heritage Foundation to enact one thing they are planning if Trump becomes president again. His first term was a practice to see how much he could break our government. He will undo our democracy if voted into power. And one of the things that Joe said was, before you had to like cloak everything in this idea of freedom and the Constitution and we the people, and you'd see these politicians on CNN and whatever, C-SPAN, with their pocket constitution. Well, they clearly have burned it.
Yeah.
They've burned that Constitution. They've burned that Bill of Rights. And now what they're saying is, this is what we've wanted to do this whole time. And we finally have
a
guy
out loud,
who says it out loud.
Well, and I think what people need to remember as well is, I think the reason the Heritage Foundation is so confident in putting something like this out is because if Donald Trump is reelected, he will never leave.
Yeah,
why would we think if he would lose?
There'd be a bloodbath.
If he
doesn't get his way. I don't love the United States unless I win. That's not patriotism.
No, it's not.
Here's, again, from the Heritage Foundation's mandate for leadership. For example, at the Department of Homeland Security, the general counsel should hire more political appointees to supervise the office's career lawyers because, quote, the legal function cannot be allowed to thwart the administration's agenda by providing stilted or erroneous legal positions, end quote. This means that if a career lawyer in the Department of Homeland Security, you know, kind of critical, says you can't do that, it's illegal, like banning people because of their religion or other anti-constitutional, unconstitutional, anti-democratic ideas, that legal advice needs to be removed by a political appointee because the administration, read the president's agenda, cannot be thwarted by the law. That's what this is saying. The law bends to the policy and politics of the Conservative Party.
You know, they could have saved 827 pages and just...
Yeah, just a short list of bullet points.
And just said, yes, men. Yes, men, yes, men, yes, men, yes, men. Sycophant, 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 sycophant.
And if you disagree, you're not a patriot. If you disagree, you're not an American. I mean, this is forcible groupthink in a very dangerous way. Again, this is a direct quote. The modern conservative president's task is to limit, control, and direct the executive branch on behalf of the American people. And the American people's needs, goals, and desires are basically assumed to be that of the conservative president.
Of course.
This is where the idea of like complete executive immunity comes from. Well, how could I ever be criminally liable for anything I did while I was in office? Because everything I do is good.
That's terrifying.
It is.
It's terrifying.
We don't have kings. That is the divine right of kings. That's a different way of explaining the divine right of kings. Of course, I can do whatever I want, and it's presumptively good and godly. Why? Because I'm doing it. I was chosen by God to lead, and therefore everything I want, everything I desire, everything that I do is presumed to be in the interests of the people that are my servants and my subordinates. It puts the will of the people as subordinate to conservative ideology.
Lots to think about, my friends. We will get links in our show notes. Stay tuned for news coming up next, followed by Todd Alba, and then Maggie will be back with the Maggie Dawn Show 2 to 4 p.m. Keep it here on the Civic Media Radio Network.